Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thank you for listening to Sound Optometry. Just a reminder that you will no longer receive a CPD point by listening to this episode of the podcast. But if you subscribe and listen to the most recent episodes of Sound Optometry, you can gain CPD points. I hope you enjoy this episode of Sound Optometry. Hello, welcome to Sound Optometry, the podcast from Docket that provides high-quality, continuing education and training for all UK-registered optometrists. You can gain one CET point by listening to this podcast and completing the exercise on our website, docket.info. I'm Michelle Hanratty. I'm an IP optometrist based in Birmingham and an assessor and examiner for the college's scheme for registration. With case studies and in-depth conversations each month, we're exploring the topics that matter the most to us optometrists. The thought of discovering an ocular tumour whilst carrying out our routine eye examination is not a pleasant one. What do you do if you suspect a patient has one? And how do you tell if it's benign or potentially malignant? Are there any telltale signs? And what if you refer a patient only to find their lesion is nothing to worry about? Will you have caused undue anxiety to the patient and added to the NHS burden? I'll be talking to Professor Heinrich Heimann of Liverpool University Hospital to answer these questions.
The earlier we can intervene, the better the chances of really healing it without any recurrence. Our biggest problem in the first place is the recurrence of the lesion.
We'll explore what signs to look out for, when to monitor, and when to refer patients that you suspect might have a tumour. And for the first time on Sound Optometry, we'll be answering questions sent in by optometrists during the recent Docket webinar on tumours of the ocular surface and anterior chamber. But first, to gain an insight from a patient's perspective, our producer, Dr. Hilary Geit, spoke to a patient called Deborah, who first noticed that her eye looked bloodshot and was eventually diagnosed with a conjunctival melanoma.
I was 58 when I was diagnosed with ocular melanoma.
Can you tell me what you first noticed?
The beginning of the year, January 2019, just suddenly my right eye became very bloodshot. There was no warning. I just woke up one day and it just looked as though it was bleeding, to be frank. I didn't think it was anything serious, but I had to go for just a regular eye test in February. And I still got it. And I mentioned to the optician when she was examining my eye. And she said, oh, no, you know, just leave it. It could take 6 months for the eye, you know, completely to clear.
Can you describe for me what your eye looked like then?
Yes, it was basically just very, very red all over, except for the blue of my iris. I actually saw a photo that was taken on Mother's Day 2019, which was March the 31st. So that was about 5-6 weeks after my eye test. And that's when I noticed this very, very pale brown fleck, but the blood was still in the outer corner of my eye with blood vessels going towards this fleck. And then I was going to the job centre because I was actually on a course. A lady there said to me, for goodness sake, will you go and get that eye looked at? It looks really, really nasty.
And what was it looking like then?
Well, I noticed then it was again very, very red. And the red was beginning to spread. The red was becoming blotchy over the other side of the eye. And I mentioned it to my daughter, who, bear in mind, she was only 16 at the time, and she said that she'd noticed it again, didn't think anything of it. But she said she had noticed that it started to grow and it had also started to go dark in colour. So I went to see my GP, and my GP asked me how long I'd had it. He took a photograph of it and he told me to go back in 2 weeks' time. Which I did, and he referred me to an eye specialist at the hospital.
So at the time you went to see your GP, did you have any other eye symptoms?
No, I didn't. I didn't even have any pain. It just, I suppose, as it was growing, my eyelid felt as though it was catching on it. I could actually feel it.
So from your GP, you were referred to the local eye hospital and then on to the regional centre, and then after that...
And then after that, he immediately referred me to Liverpool, to St Paul's Research Centre. It's an eye hospital. And on December the 13th, 2019, I had the tumour removed and was obviously sent off for biopsy. And on the 31st of December, New Year's Eve, the nurse told me that it was a melanoma. and that I would have to have treatment. But that would be something that they would speak to me about over the next few weeks, because my eye needed to heal from the biopsy. And then in February, I went up to have a radiotherapy treatment, and I had to wait for about 6 weeks for the eye to heal. Once my eye had healed, I was given chemotherapy drops to put in my eye 4 times a day for 7 days. And then I had 3 weeks off. And then I had another 7 days, 4 times a day.
Was there a point where you were given the all clear from them?
It was about November, and I saw one of Professor Heinemann's doctors, and he said that it had been a success. They'd taken photographs again, and it had been a success, and I was now in remission.
Deborah, thank you so much for telling your story.
You're very welcome. If it helps other people, then I'll have done my job. Thank you.
You can see a photo of Deborah's eye on the course page for this podcast on the Docket website. Joining me now is Professor Heinrich Heinemann, consultant ophthalmic surgeon and clinical lead of the Ocular Oncology Unit at Royal Liverpool Hospital. Welcome.
Hello.
So your team treated Deborah in Liverpool. Is this a typical story of a patient?
It pretty much is. Most patients would think that if you have a cancerous disease of the ocular surface, there will be something dramatic like a lot of pain or massive bleed or visual loss. And it's typical that it starts with very, very little symptoms, like in Deborah's case with a hemorrhage, or it could just be an itch or a foreign body sensation. And then it sort of continues to get more and more over time. So most of our patients really come with a, I would say, delay of around 6 months between the first sign of any change to the diagnosis.
So that's quite interesting, because in Deborah's case, she thought she saw a small bleed on the eye, and that's clearly what the optometrist saw as well. And we do see quite a lot of subconjunctival hemorrhages, don't we? So it's a bit worrying that this did actually turn out to be a melanoma.
Again, this is your typical, untypical case. It might even be just a coincidence, to be honest. So it's very rare for melanomas of the conjunctiva to cause a visible bleed. Most of them really just grow over years, and it may just have been a coincidence, and then you looked a little bit closer, and then you see some pigmentation there that's slowly growing and then bleeding again. But it's very hard for patients also to say, oh, there's a kind of pigmentation or dark spot or so. Bleeding is much easier to understand and to see. So it's really a classic description of a non-typical presentation. Just like Deborah's case, in the majority of cases, it starts like that. So that's not something missing from the optometrist, optician, anyone. It is the typical story. Most of them start like little things that you don't really see the malignant potential in it.
So it might have been that she had the pigmented area, like the freckle. She described a very faint brown area, didn't she, at the very beginning? So it could have been that.
Exactly.
So how important is it to get an early diagnosis in cases like this?
Well, on the one hand, it's very important, because the earlier we can intervene, the better the chances of really healing it without any recurrence. Our biggest problem in the first place is the recurrence of the lesion. The second one in melanomas is metastatic disease, but recurrence is our main problem of the other conjunctival lesions, and the larger the lesion, the more widespread, the higher the rate of recurrence. On the other hand, these are usually slowly growing tumors, so it's not something that if you delay the diagnosis by 2 or 4 weeks, there will be a dramatic difference. Most of these lesions usually grow over months, really, sometimes over years.
So in the short term, there isn't really a huge risk to the patient if there's a slight delay in the diagnosis, but if there's a long delay, it could increase the risk of recurrence, or it could potentially mean that the cancer spreads to other parts of the body, maybe?
Exactly. So the message of this should not be sent everything straight away, because there are so many little lesions of the ocular surface. You and everybody else would go crazy. You definitely have some weeks with that to monitor it. The monitoring is the key thing in this, but you don't need to be afraid. If I don't send this now, next week, there will be a dramatic difference in the outcome.
Just looking at thinking about the topic more broadly, what are the most common ocular tumours that we might encounter in optometric practice? We've obviously just mentioned conjunctival melanoma.
Yes, so the most common one actually are the squamous cell changes, meaning the epithelial changes of the conjunctiva. These are the most common ones, but still very, very rare. We have less than 100 cases in the whole of the UK per year. They're a lot more common in Australia, for instance, in the Caucasian population there. Melanomas, fortunately, are a lot less common. We're about 50 cases or so per year.
You mentioned that the incidence is much higher in Australia, which leads me on to the next question about risk factors. So presumably UV exposure is a risk factor.
Yeah, definitely.
And what are the other risk factors? Are there any others?
Age, mainly. It is a lot more common in the age group of about 60, 70. Sun exposure is the one for mainly squamous cell changes. For melanomas, there are controversies regarding that. So some groups think it is associated with sun exposure, others think not. Squamous cell changes, definitely. So that's important in the history of the patient. So in our areas, it would be sailors or farmers or patients that lived in South Africa or the like in Zimbabwe for many years and then returned to the UK.
And when you say that age is a risk factor, is it because they've had an accumulation of UV exposure over their lifetime?
Exactly. And this is why at the moment male gender also is a risk factor. We think it's linked to the exposure. The farm workers and sailors would have been in those age bracket 50, 60, 70 years ago, more males than females, really.
And if you are looking at a patient that has a lesion on their eye, on their ocular surface, what are the telltale signs when you're trying to differentiate between a benign lesion and a malignant one?
Yeah, I would love to answer that question, but there are none really other than it doesn't go away and does get bigger over time, and it has surprisingly little symptoms for what you see. So inflammatory lesions have a lot more symptoms because they cause an inflammatory reaction, and all your inflammatory cells will cause you pain and itching and things like that. Whereas these lesions, they're just cells that grow. They don't destroy much in the beginning. Therefore, you don't have any pain, you don't have any inflammation, and a typical symptom of the patient, though it's been there for weeks or months and it's growing, but other than that, it's not much of a problem really. For squamous cell things, it would be looking at keratinization, really. So look if you have some white bits that look like pearly white bits in it. For melanocytic lesions, look at the spread of it. If you have a non-pigmented lesion, it can be a melanoma as well. Always look for some pigment on the side. So most melanomas, even if they're not pigmented, have an area, an edge or so, with a little bit of pigment, a little bit like cinnamon dust or so. These are signs to look out for.
So that's the ocular surface, but what about tumours of the anterior segment, sort of the iris and the ciliary body? What signs might the optometrist be looking out for when they're examining the anterior segment generally? Is there anything they should be doing differently so they don't miss anything?
They're just little signs that sometimes are not well known because they're in the hidden corner of the eye, in the ciliary body, behind the iris. So nobody can see small tumours in the ciliary body. It's absolutely impossible. They're asymptomatic. They will only cause symptoms if they get a little bit bigger. So starting with the anterior segment examination, look for any unusual pigmentation on the iris, but most importantly in the chamber angle, really. So that if you see little signs of an invasion of the chamber angle, then for an optometrist, opticians, the most important thing would be a lenticular astigmatism, which is very often the first sign that doesn't get noticed at all. So the patient has a change in glasses and you measure it, and out of a sudden, you know, in a 60-year-old, you've got 1.5 diopters of astigmatism that wasn't there before. This is a ciliary body tumor pushing on the lens and changing the refraction of the lens. That then goes on to unilateral cataract. If you have a big difference in the lens, that you have really almost a white cataract in one eye and a clear lens in the other, it should always be in the differential diagnosis that there's something in the ciliary body. And finally, a sentinel blood vessel. These are almost always present in large ciliary body tumors, meaning you have a blood vessel on the scleral surface, not on the conjunctiva, on the scleral surface, and virtually no inflammation around it. Just one big blood vessel dipping down into the ciliary body. This is a telltale sign of a ciliary body tumor, really. And then you need to do the extra examinations. Look for the other signs. Usually one or two other signs, like an angle infiltration would be present, or you can see in mydriasis that the tumor is indenting on the lens, something like that. That is really, really tricky.
And when a patient does eventually get seen at their local hospital, how is the lesion investigated?
Well, then it depends on the consultant in charge, so to say. If they feel there could be a malignancy, they have to refer to one of the four ocular oncology centers in the country, and then the clock starts ticking, basically. So the patient needs to be seen by one of the centers within 31 days, and if it's a malignancy, it needs to be treated within 62 days. So there are clear guidelines on that.
Right. And if a patient is investigated, how long do they normally have to wait for a confirmed diagnosis?
So we get the what we say black and white picture, meaning cancer or not, within 3-4 days. And then there are additional stains on the cells. So sometimes you can't make the diagnosis based on the look of the cells only. You need some special stains. So that color picture we usually get within 7 to 10 days. So the diagnosis usually is made within a week in most cases. And there are the lymphoma cases sometimes need a bit longer because they need special subtyping of it.
Mm. Once a patient has been diagnosed with a malignant tumour, what does the treatment typically involve?
Basically, for squamous cell changes and melanomas, it's pretty much exactly the same. So the number one priority is the excision of the lesion, which is feasible in about 80-90% of cases. So that's the most important thing, that you remove the whole lesion with your first surgery. In order to lower the risk for recurrence, both of these groups will have adjuvant treatment, local radiotherapy with a ruthenium plaque, and topical chemotherapy, which is mitomycin C in melanoma and 5-FU in squamous cell changes. In lymphoma, we usually cannot remove the whole lesion. We do an incisional biopsy, meaning only parts of them are examined under the microscope, and that is usually treated either with radiotherapy or, if the patient has lymphoma elsewhere, with systemic chemotherapy.
Thank you. All GOC-registered optometrists can catch up with Professor Hyman's webinar, which explored this topic in depth. Just follow the webinar's link from the Docket homepage. You're listening to Sound Optometry with me, Michelle Hanratty. Every month, we're exploring the topics that matter the most to us optometrists, and that's where we want to hear from you. If there's a topic you want us to cover or have a fascinating case you want to share, email us podcast@docket.info or tweet @soundoptometry. Now we'll be putting some of your questions to Professor Hyman. Thanks to those of you that sent them in. Professor Hyman, we received a lot of questions about the patient age. How much of a difference does this actually make?
It does make quite a difference. You can sort of be a lot less scared about the lesions, let's say, in a 20-year-old or a 30-year-old than compared to a 60 or 70-year-old.
So if you do see a lesion in a younger person, do they actually need to be referred or do they just need to be monitored?
It's a very good question. The big problem we have, usually it's conjunctival nevi in teenagers. That's your typical group. And they grow. And then you think, oh my God, it's growing. It's something that can be dangerous. 99% of them are harmless, are nevi when you remove them. But 1% is not. The problem is you don't know the 1%. And what we usually do, we discuss this with the patient. So look, we can do two things. We can watch it or we can remove it. Removal on the one hand is easy, but it can always leave a mini scar of the conjunctiva, and you all know how sensitive some patients are with the ocular surface. So there are some patients that have a dry eye from that day on and are really, really unhappy after even a small conjunctival biopsy. There are some cases, in particular in children, where the suture material that you need, the Vicryl, causes a granuloma. So I say, look, I don't know what it is. It's 99%. It is a nevus in your case. I cannot exclude 100%. We can watch it. And if it's growing, then we can do something about it or we can remove it. Obviously, the disadvantage of watching it is you need to watch it. You need to observe it.
Mm. So you do expect them to grow in teenagers. So how much growth would be abnormal?
Difficult to say. They should stop in the 20s, really. Anything that grows after that should be suspicious. And just to follow that on, if you have a 40-year-old or 50-year-old coming to you saying, this is new, that wasn't there before, and perhaps you have one of a good digital photograph where you can sort of see this area, and this is a new lesion, that's a completely different kettle of fish. This is something that needs to be examined.
One of the next questions that we were asked is, since conjunctival melanoma can only be diagnosed by histology, would you advise to refer any new pigmentary area or small thickening of the bulbar conjunctiva for further investigation if it's unilateral?
Again, that's an excellent question. I'd like to sort of skip out of that, but I can't. But basically, if it's a new lesion, that's pretty obvious. Yes, it needs to be seen in one way or another if it is not in a young patient, really. So anybody 40, 50, 60, why do I say I'm having trouble answering this question? If you look really, really, really closely, there are some reports, if you make the best examination of the world of everybody, you find some conjunctival pigmentation in up to 16% of everyone. So if you have some conjunctival pigmentation that is growing over time in, let's say, a 50 or 60-year-old, that's something that should be seen by an ophthalmologist.
So with regards to ciliary body tumours now, one person said that they would only avert lids during contact lens checkups unless there were symptoms. How often would I be missing pathology?
Yeah. It's a good question, meaning I think you should look at the four quadrants of the sclera conjunctiva on a basic examination if you see the patient for the first time or if they have symptoms. You don't need to turn the lid around. To see a sentinel blood vessel or to see a conjunctival melanoma in the bulbar conjunctiva or tarsal conjunctiva, you just need to slightly detach the lids from the globe or let the patient look into the four quadrants. And that's a very good question because a lot of people don't do that. And this is why a lot of patients come late, although they have an easy to see conjunctival melanoma on the bulbar surface. It's covered by the lid and you don't see it because simply you don't let them look up and down. So that should be standard of your first examination.
And if an optometrist does decide to monitor a lesion that they've spotted rather than refer, how often should they follow up the patient? What should the time interval be?
That depends really on the specific case and the dynamics of the case. So if somebody comes, oh, this is new for the last 4 or 6 weeks and it's not going away, then I probably would, in the ocular surface, do a short-term follow-up. So I would see them after 4 to 6 weeks to see if it's better, if it's smaller, inflammatory or so. And if it's growing, then that needs to raise awareness. If it's something the patient said, look, I had this for years and I'm not sure, can you have a look at it? You probably have a longer follow-up. So our usual follow-up for a lesion, we're not quite sure in these cases is 4 months and then 6 months the next time and then once a year, really, with the advice of self-monitoring because ocular surface, the patient or let's say the spouse can have a look at that as well.
And I know you've touched on this already, but good record keeping is really essential in these scenarios. So how valuable are photographic records when it comes to diagnosing lesions?
Yes, so probably the most important piece of information out of all of this is photos, photos, photos. So my glaucoma colleague Mark Butterbury always says, if you have an intruder into your house, he runs off and you go to the police, what would you like to show the police? A drawing of the person or a photograph? I mean, would be the photograph. So the same applies here, really. So photograph has so much information, in particular these lesions. You take 100 pictures totally in vain, but the one case you'll be so glad that you've taken a picture and you can clearly document there is growth of it. Otherwise, you're guessing.
Mm. I mean, I've used a slit lamp camera for years and, you know, I love using my slit lamp camera, but actually my slit lamp camera is broken at the moment. So I have actually taken just to using a mobile phone, but it really can be that simply if you've got a good mobile phone, you could actually just have a mobile phone in the practice and have that set up for photographing patients and make sure you're not breaking any data protection rules. But even a photograph from a phone camera would still be useful, wouldn't it, if it was a good quality photograph?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, there are little things that you can put on your slit lamp or little adapters for it if you don't want to buy a camera. These mobile phones are so great. And unfortunately, what you mentioned is a very important point, you know, data safety and all the rest of it. Of course, you have to comply with that. But there are a lot more errors made by trying to cover patient safety rather than document the lesion. And I have a colleague of mine. The simplest thing is, yes, I do that on my mobile phone. He takes the mobile phone and videos the patient. Do you consent with using your photographs in my practice, things like that. That's what you need, really. Of course, you should have a system where you file them because you may need that photograph in 6 years.
And of course, the patient can take their own photographs as well if they're self-monitoring.
Well, that is a fantastic point. So I think everybody will be super happy if you just send it to the patient. They have it on their mobile phone. Patients are mobile nowadays. They move from Birmingham to Liverpool or whatever, change it. And if they just have it on their mobile phone showing the optician, this is what it looked like a year ago. So I can only recommend send it to the patient, tell the patient, have it on your mobile phone. And that's the best place where it could be.
And finally, just to finish off before we part ways, can you summarise the simple things that optometrists can do in practice right now that could really make a difference?
Well, remember that the clinical signs of ocular surface tumours are not specific and not dramatic at all. They never come with pain or massive hemorrhages or massive tumours. Just stay on the ball and keep on checking them, and then you can't miss anything. Don't be afraid. Not every patient has to be sent straight away one day later to treatment or so, but don't lose them. Loss to follow-up is our biggest problem in daily practice, really. So it's a fine line between not scaring the patient unnecessarily. On the other hand, if they're lost to follow-up and not really coming, this is our biggest problem in daily practice.
Professor Hyman, thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to Sound Optometry. If you would like more information about anterior ocular lesions, go to our website, docket.info, and search for Sound Optometry to find the additional reading materials. Listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on the website will gain one CET point covering communication, standards of practice, and ocular disease. We'll be taking a break for the summer, but when we're back in September, we'll be discussing infection control in an optometrist's environment. We'd really appreciate it if you help spread the word about the podcast. Tell your colleagues to listen, or subscribe to the series so you don't miss an episode. The producers are Dr. Hilary Guite and Jason Hoskin. I'm Michelle Hanratty. Have a lovely summer, and thanks for listening.